and we didn't look at one another or speak. There was really nothing to be said. The crematorium was in the suburbs, a 1970s monstrosity of white concrete and brutal angles. The gardens were neat in a sterile municipal way, but surprisingly were full of beautiful blown roses. There were lots of mature trees around the perimeter, which pleased me. I liked to think of their roots, coursing with life, snaking under this place. We drew up in an enormous car park which was already almost full, although it was only 10:30. The place was out of the way and would be impossible to reach by public transport, which was completely illogical. There ought to be a train or a shuttle bus, I thought. It was a place we were all guaranteed to be visiting at some point. Raymond paid the driver and we stood for a moment, taking it in. "Ready?" he said. I nodded. There were lots of other mourners, moving through the grounds like slow black beetles. We walked up the path in silent agreement that we were in no hurry to leave the trees and the roses and the sunshine and go inside. A long hearse sat at the front door and we looked at the coffin, which was covered in wreaths. A coffin was a wooden box in which Sammy's corpse would be lying. What was he wearing in there, I wondered. I hoped it was that nice red jumper, cosy, smelling of him. We sat down on the left-hand side of the room, in a pew not too far from the front. The place was half full already, and there was a low hum of muttered conversation, a muted, insect-like buzzing that I hadn't heard in any other venue or set of circumstances. I picked up one of the sheets that had been placed along the pews. "Samuel McMurray Tom," it said, 1940 to 2017. Inside it told us what would happen, listed the readings and hymns, and suddenly I was overwhelmed with a desire for it to be over, not to have to be there and experience it all. Raymond and I were silent. The room was much nicer inside than the exterior had suggested, with wooden beams and a high vaulted ceiling. The entire side wall to the left of where we were seated was glass, and we could see the rolling lawns and more of those huge primeval trees in the background. I was glad. Nature should make her presence felt in the room in some way, I thought. Living nature, not cut flowers. The sun was quite bright now, and the trees cast short shadows, although autumn was creeping up through a shimmer of wind in the leaves. I turned around and saw that the room was full, perhaps 100 people, maybe more. The buzzing hum threatened to drown out the dull recorded organ music. Something shifted in the air and silence fell. Both of his sons and four other men, whose faces I recognised from the party, carried Sammy's coffin down the aisle and placed it gently on a sort of raised platform with a roller belt, at the end of which was a set of red velvet curtains. I tried to remember what the platform reminded me of, and it came to me. The supermarket checkout in Tesco, where you place your items and then move towards the cashier. I leaned across to tell Raymond, but he had fished a bag of peppermints from his suit pocket and offered me one before I could speak. I popped it in and sucked. Other people had joined us on the pew, and we'd had to shuffle up like crabs to make space for them. I was therefore in very close proximity to Mr. Raymond Gibbons. I noticed that he smelled extremely pleasant today. The peppermints, of course, but also a clean soap scent, something almost woody, like cedar. I hadn't seen him smoke a cigarette yet. I suppose even Raymond would think it inappropriate to smoke a cigarette outside a crematorium. The rest of the family entered and sat beside Sammy's boys on the front pew. Laura was on her own, looking impossibly glamorous. Dark glasses, indoors, astonishing. They were followed by a jolly-looking minister. A man at a keyboard tucked away in the corner flexed his fingers and started to play, and we shuffled to our feet. The words to the hymn were printed in the booklet, but I found that I could remember them from childhood. The communal singing was of extremely poor quality, more like an atonal mumble, and the minister's unpleasant voice was overly loud, perhaps because he was wearing a lapel microphone. He really ought to turn it off for the hymns, I thought. There was no need to amplify his caterwauling. Raymond, to my immense surprise, had a pleasant light tenor, and he was singing properly, unlike most other people. When did people become embarrassed to sing in public? Was it because of the decline in church-going? And yet the television schedule was full of singing contests in which people, however untalented, were far from shy about participating. Perhaps people are only interested in giving solo performances. Surely this was the ultimate in disrespect, to attend a man's funeral and mumble during hymns which, however dreary, had been specifically selected to commemorate his life. I began to sing more loudly. Raymond and I were making more noise than the next four pews put together, and I was glad of it. The words were incredibly sad, and for an atheist like myself, entirely without hope or comfort, but still, it was our duty to sing them to the best of our ability and to sing proudly in honour of Sammy. I sat down when it was finished, happy that Raymond and I had shown him the respect he deserved. Quite a few people turned around to look at us, presumably because they had enjoyed our vocal tribute. The minister spoke about Sammy's life. It was interesting to hear that he'd grown up near a tiny village in the northeast on a sheep farm. He'd joined the Merchant Navy when he left school, but soon tiring of life at sea, he'd pitched up in Glasgow with £10, a new suit, and no desire whatsoever to return to farming. He'd met Jean in Woolworths, looking for a needle and thread. The minister, looking pleased with himself, said that they'd stitched a happy life together after that. There was a brief religious bit, the usual balderdash, and then, like the assistant in Tesco, he made the coffin conveyor belt move, and Sammy checked out. Bright as a button, smile plastered on as though this were the best part of the whole terrible event, the minister announced that we would sing the final hymn. Raymond and I made a valiant effort, but it's impossible to sing when you're crying. There's a lump like a plumstone lodged in your throat, and the music can't get past it. Raymond blew his nose and passed me a packet of tissues, which I gratefully accepted. The family, the minister told us, would be very pleased if we would join them afterwards at the Hawthorne House Hotel for light refreshments. The congregation filed out, shaking hands and mumbling meaningless platitudes. I did the same. There was a collection basket for the British Heart Foundation, in lieu of flowers, and I saw Raymond drop in a £20 note. I put in £3 coins. If anything, I felt that this was overly generous. Researching new drugs and efficacious treatments for heart disease cost hundreds of millions of pounds. £3 or £300. It was hardly going to swing the balance between finding and not finding a cure, after all. I perched on a low wall behind the crematorium and turned my face to the sun. I felt utterly exhausted. After a moment, Raymond sat beside me, and I heard the click of his lighter. I didn't even have the energy to move away. He blew out a long stream of smoke.
"All right," he said.
I nodded. "You?"
He shrugged. "Not a big fan of funerals, to be honest," he said.
He looked away.
"Reminds me of my dad. It was years ago, but it's still hard, you know."
I nodded. That made sense. Time only blunts the pain of loss. It doesn't erase it. "I really, really, really do not want to go to the Hawthorne House Hotel for light refreshments, Raymond," I said. "I want to stop thinking about death. I just want to go home, put on normal clothes, and watch television." Raymond stubbed his cigarette out and then buried it in the flower bed behind us. "No one wants to go to these things, Eleanor," he said gently. "You have to, though, for the family." I must have looked sad. "You don't need to stay long," he said, his voice soft and patient. "Just show face, have a cup of tea, eat a sausage roll. You know the drill." "Well, I hope they've at least got a high meat content and friable pastry," I said, more in hope than expectation, and shouldering my handbag. The Hawthorne House Hotel was walking distance from the crematorium. The woman at the reception desk smiled, and it was impossible not to notice that she had only one front tooth. The remaining molars were the exact same shade as Coleman's English mustard. I'm not one to make judgments about other people's personal appearance, but really, of all the available staff, was this woman the best choice for the front desk? She directed us to the Bramble Suite and flashed us a gappy, sympathetic smile. We were among the last to arrive, as most people had driven the short journey from the crematorium to the hotel. The crematorium was a busy place, and the parking spaces were needed, I supposed. I'm not sure I'd like to be burned. I think I might like to be fed to zoo animals. It would be both environmentally friendly and a lovely treat for the larger carnivores. Could you request that? I wondered. I made a mental note to write to the WWF in order to find out. I went up to Keith and told him how very sorry I was, and then I sought out Gary to say the same thing. Both of them looked overwhelmed, which was understandable. It takes a long time to learn to live with loss, assuming you ever manage it. After all these years, I'm still something of a work in progress in that regard. The grandchildren sat quietly in the corner, cowed perhaps by the sombre atmosphere. The other person I had to pass on my condolences to was Laura, but I couldn't spot her. She was usually easy to find. Today, as well as the huge sunglasses, she'd been wearing vertiginous heels, a short black dress with a plunging neckline, and her hair was piled on top of her head in an artful birdcage creation that added several inches to her height. There being no sign of her, and no sign of the promised refreshments either, I went in search of the lavatories. I would have put money on their having a dusty bowl of apricot-scented potpourri beside the washbasins, and I was right. On the way back, I spotted a telltale platform heel poking out from behind a swagged curtain. There was a window seat recess, in which Laura was sitting in the lap of a man who, it soon became apparent, was Raymond, although they were embracing so closely that it took a moment before I could see his face and be sure. He was wearing black leather shoes, I noticed, so he did at least possess a pair. I went back into the Bramble Suite without disturbing them. They hadn't seen me, being very much otherwise engaged. This was an all too familiar social scenario for me, standing alone, staring into the middle distance. It was absolutely fine. It was absolutely normal. After the fire at each new school, I tried so hard, but something about me just didn't fit. There was, it seemed, no Eleanor-shaped social hole for me to slot into. I wasn't good at pretending, that was the thing. After what had happened in that burning house, given what went on there, I could see no point in being anything other than truthful with the world. I had, literally, nothing left to lose. But by careful observation from the sidelines, I'd worked out that social success is often built on pretending just a little. Popular people sometimes have to laugh at things they don't find very funny, do things they don't particularly want to, with people whose company they don't particularly enjoy. Not me. I had decided years ago that if the choice was between that or flying solo, then I'd fly solo. It was safer that way. Grief is the price we pay for love, so they say. The price is far too high. The buffet had been laid out. Yes, there were sausage rolls, but also sandwiches. Staff were dispensing indistinguishable tea and coffee from bitter-smelling urns into industrial white crockery. This wouldn't do at all. I was decidedly not in the mood for hot brown liquid, oh no. I was in the mood for cool, clear vodka. All hotels had bars, didn't they? I wasn't a great frequenter of hostelries, but I knew that bedrooms and bars were their raison d'être. I spoke to the dentally challenged lady in reception again, who directed me down another long corridor, at the end of which lay the imaginatively named Hawthorne Lounge. I stood on the threshold and looked around. The place was deserted, the fruit machines flashing purely for their own amusement. I walked in. Just me, Eleanor,
alone.
A barman was watching TV and absent-mindedly polishing glasses.
"Home's under the hammer," he said, turning towards me.
I remember thinking, surprised, that he was possibly attractive, and then chastising myself for the thought. My prejudice was that beautiful, glamorous people would not be at work in the Hawthorne House Hotel on a Friday lunchtime. Granted, the receptionist had confirmed my initial thoughts, but really it was shameful of me to have these preconceptions. Where on earth did they come from? A little voice whispered the answer in my head. Mummy. The barman smiled, revealing a lovely set of teeth and clear blue eyes.
"It's a load of old shite," he said, in a voice that could strip paint from walls after giving them a good sanding down first.
"See? Told you," Mummy whispered.
"Is it?" I said. "Unfortunately, I'm not generally at home during the day to see it."
"Watch it here if you like,"
the man said, shrugging. "Could I?"
"Why not?" he said. "It's not like there's much else going on, is there?"
He gestured around the empty bar. I perched on a bar stool, something I've always wanted to try, and ordered a vodka and cola. He made it slowly, added ice and lemon without asking, and pushed it towards me.
"Funeral, was it?" he said.
I wondered how he knew, and then I realised that I was dressed entirely in black, that my smoky eye makeup had run somewhat, and that there was no other reason to be in this particular venue at this time of day. I nodded. No further exchanges were required, and we both settled back to see how Ian and Dorothy would fare with the 1970s terrace that they'd bought at auction for £95,000, intending to renovate the bathroom, install a new kitchen, and knock through from the lounge to the dining room.
"The finishing touch," the presenter said, "was to paint the front door this fetching shade of green."
"Green door," the barman said, without missing a beat, and seconds later, lo and behold, that very song began to play.
We both laughed, and he pushed another vodka towards me without my having to ask. We had moved on to Loose Women, another programme I was unfamiliar with. I was on my fourth vodka by now, and the funeral service was there in my mind, but it didn't hurt. Like noticing you had a stone in your shoe, but while you were sitting down, rather than walking on it. I thought that I probably ought to attempt a sausage roll at some point, or at least put a few in my bag for later. But then I remembered that I had brought my new tiny bag, into which I could fit at most two savoury pastries. I tottered and shook my head.
"What's up?" said the barman.
We hadn't asked each other's names. It didn't seem necessary somehow. I slumped forward on my stool and stared, in cliched fashion, into my glass.
"Oh, it's nothing," I said breezily. "I suppose I ought to have something to eat now, really."
The barman, who had become less handsome as time had worn on, picked up my glass, filled it back up with vodka and a dash of cola, and returned it to me.
"No rush, eh?" he said. "Why not stay here and keep me company for a while longer?"
I looked around. The bar was still deserted.
"You might need a little lie down after this one, eh?"
he said, tapping my glass and leaning very close to me. I could see the enlarged pores on the sides of his nose, some of them filled with microscopic black dots.
"Perhaps," I said. "Sometimes I do need a lie down after vodka and cola."
He smiled wolfishly.
"Puts you in the mood, eh?"
I tried to lift my eyebrows into a question, but strangely could only make one of them rise. I'd had too much to drink because I'd had too much pain, and there was nowhere else it could go but down, drowned in the vodka. Simple, really.
"What do you mean?"
I said, hearing that I was pronouncing the consonants somewhat indistinctly.
"Funerals," he said,
moving closer to me so that his face was almost pressed against mine. He smelled of onions.
"It's nothing to feel bad about," he said. "All that death."
Afterwards, don't you find...